Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Diane Sachs is president of Sachs Facts, a business providing strategic advice and presentations on climate, energy, and environment. She has given hundreds of well-received presentations across Ontario and beyond. From 2015 to 2019, Dr. Diane Sachs was the Environmental Commissioner of Ontario, an office that has since been abolished. Prior to her appointment, Dr. Sachs was one of Canada's most respected environmental lawyers with 40 years of experience. Welcome to Earth Matters, Dr. Sachs.
Thank you very much.
So I want to start off by asking, obviously with 40 years environmental law experience, what got you interested in that facet of law? Obviously you're interested in law, you've got a PhD in law. What was it about environmental law that piqued your curiosity?
Oh, a mad passion for the natural world and wanting to do something to protect it.
And 40 years, what changes had you seen over the 40 years?
Well, we worked really hard for 40 years, and some things got better. One of the classic examples is lead pollution. Older people like me have pretty high body loads of lead, which we know is a neurotoxin, has a lifelong impact on intelligence and impulse control and crime, and it's a very serious human poison. So getting lead banned, taken out of gasoline as well as out of paint, hugely important achievements that I guess people take for granted today. Another one is the protection of the ozone layer. The refrigerants, chlorofluorocarbons, were visibly destroying the ozone layer, which is essential to protect us from some of the very damaging rays from the sun, which cause cancer and blindness. And that was one of the cases where the nations of the world got together under the auspices of the Montreal Protocol, which was actually signed in Canada, to all agree to use laws to force the companies that were making these dangerous chemicals to replace them with less harmful chemicals and give the ozone layer a chance to heal. So those are two of the big wins that I've seen in my career. But we've also seen a lot of running fast to stay still. So, for example, a car these days emits only about a quarter of the pollution per kilometer that it did when I was young, but we collectively drive more than four times as much.
You mentioned the Montreal Protocol, and that's way back in the 80s, and Canada's been resting on those laurels for a long time. Very briefly, can you give us an update to what Canada has been doing in the last little while? Because I know a lot of people are curious about the oil sands out in Alberta, but also I also want to touch on what I'll call the scientific chill that we went through for a few years, that scientists were muzzled and were not allowed to talk to media and the public on what they thought.
We've had a really unfortunate polarization that I've seen over my career, where a series of conservative or right-wing governments have been really hostile to science. So when you talk about the chill, that occurred under Stephen Harper, the conservative government, who really strongly disliked the evidence that scientists were producing about the immense harm that fossil fuels cause. And instead of focusing on ways to reduce the harm, they focused on ways to shut up the scientists. We're seeing the same thing being repeated now under the Republican government in the U.S. So the focusing first on the federal government, the Liberal government is far from perfect. I've never seen a perfect government or a perfect human. But on the whole, they've been doing a pretty good job. Certainly, they take climate change more seriously than any government we've had before. And the Pan-Canadian Framework, which most of the provinces and territories and federal government agreed to together in 2016 as a way to work towards delivering our Paris commitment, a huge series of steps forward. Is it enough? No, but extremely important, including carbon pricing, but also serious work on science, some serious work on adaptation, some serious work on regulations to reduce pollution, such as the Clean Fuel Standard, and a really deeply serious attempt to make a national agreement to work on these issues. And that's really challenging for Canada, both because a big part of our economy is based on oil and gas, and because the production of oil and gas is concentrated in certain provinces. So the gains and losses, both from climate change and from climate action, are distributed differently across the country. And the Liberal federal government has tried really hard to craft a grand compromise that would give everybody something enough that the country as a whole could work together on climate action, and the result has been mixed. But I will say that at the Paris Climate Conference in 2015, Canada played a important role in helping make that agreement possible. And what Canada does now in this election, I think, is very important to the future of the Paris Agreement. And the Paris Agreement really is our best chance of avoiding being toasted, roasted, and grilled. And if we allow it to be sidelined, ignored, and undercut, which I think would happen if Canada turns away from it, I think the consequences will be global and very serious. Canada matters at this point.
For almost 5 years, you were the Environmental Commissioner in charge of overseeing the Environmental Bill of Rights in Ontario, a province in Canada. Can you tell us what the Environmental Bill of Rights is and the role of the Commissioner?
So the Environmental Bill of Rights was in place for 25 years until February this year, and it's a series of tools to give the public a voice in the protection of the environment. It rests on two key insights. First, that the environment is too important to be left entirely to the government. And secondly, that even within the government, it's too important to be left entirely to the Ministry of Environment, which is a fairly small ministry without central organizing powers. As commissioner, it was my job to try to, first of all, to try to be the guardian of the environmental rights, Bill of Rights, both to help and encourage the public to exercise their rights and to cajole, coax, embarrass, shame, assist the government to fulfill its obligations. And we did a really good job of that. The other part of my job was to report to the members of the legislature, by whom I was unanimously appointed, and through them to the public annually on at least these three major topics: energy conservation, environmental protection, and climate change. And I, in total, delivered 17 reports to the legislature during that period of time. And so what I found was that many people across Ontario are increasingly unsure what information they can trust, and that it uncertainty is, I really regret to say, justified, because sometimes now even the government's put out false or misleading information, or worse, more common, hide information. So I found that people were really grateful to have a nonpartisan, neutral source providing reliable information with, you know, I had nothing personal to gain. It was just my job to tell the truth to power. And I found that there was a lot of real gratitude for our ability to do that and to do it in a clear and accessible way, and then to travel the province delivering that information to people in a way that they could access.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned 17 reports. They're all available on your website, saxfacts.com, under reports, and you cover a number of different areas. The most recent one you had, and unfortunately, not only did you lose your job, the dozen people or so that worked in your office lost their job, but the whole commission was shut down. That's pretty dramatic. It's tough to be, as you say, the voice to power, to be an ombudsman to sort of reflect the reality to the powers that be. But it seems a bit of a overreaction to shut down the whole office and not even bother with it anymore.
Yes, well, it is, I think, a significant loss to Ontario. The three of the independent officers were eliminated. The French language commissioner, the children's advocate, who was doing stunningly important work to not only provide a general policy overview on children, but an advocacy role for specific children, particularly the First Nations kids that we know have had such a difficult time, and my office, the whole structure of independent oversight on the environment, energy, and climate.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that the province of Ontario has been impoverished by those losses, and you know, I don't have evidence as to the reason for it, but I can only assume that this is a situation such as we saw under Mr. Harper, where the government doesn't want facts available to the public other than the ones they prefer to emphasize. And the problem with this is the facts don't go away just because the government doesn't like them.
Right.
The climate crisis isn't like a normal political negotiation that you can solve through compromise between different interests. The climate crisis is a collision between humans and physics. And physics doesn't compromise.
Mm-hmm.
So Tom Tolles, the Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist, has done a wonderful cartoon where he shows a politician standing with a piece of paper in the middle of every conceivable climate crisis. Their wildfires are burning, and the sea is rising, and the waves are crashing in, and the wind is howling. And so he's holding his piece of paper and saying, okay, the votes have been counted, and this isn't happening.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
It's like saying the world is flat. You can believe the world is flat all you like. The world doesn't care.
The elimination of the couple of different commissions, yours included, was not the only thing that the Ontario government did. They've introduced a couple of bills. One, and I want to talk a little bit about language, one's called Restoring Competitiveness, and the other one was More Homes, More Choice, which sounds popular, but environmental groups from a wide variety of areas, not just in Ontario, are dismayed at these because they seem to open the door for development. And it reminds me of what's going on in New South Wales and Australia, where under the guise of improving things, they're actually opening the door to allowing in Australia's case, farmers and grazers to develop and cut down more forests. In Ontario, it's more about homes and under the guise of affordable homes, let's expand into what's called the Greenbelt area and let's build more houses because we need more houses. So talk to me a little bit about the deciduous use of language and you know, what's really the agenda that's driving these initiatives?
What I have observed consistently since the June 2018 election is the methodical destruction of environmental protections, the methodical defunding of environmental and public health guardians, so as to make it easier in the short run for certain small groups to make a lot of money. The destruction of environmental protections, the narrowing of the funding, flushing the funding of health units and conservation authorities and environmental enforcement, reducing the ability of municipalities to protect their urban boundaries and the green spaces and agricultural land around them. All of this seems to be designed to make it easier and quicker to turn areas that shouldn't be subdivisions into subdivisions. Now, we know that the development industry makes a lot of money and donates a lot of money. That's why I have said several times over the years that the land development industry is Ontario's oil sands. It is the largest driver of our greenhouse gas emissions. It is increasingly locking us into a high carbon future that we're not going to be able to sustain, and it is very dominant in Ontario politics, and these bills seem designed to make more money for those folks at the loss of everybody else. Chapter 4 of my last full report, my energy report, was all about urban sprawl and how it makes the lives of individuals worse, locks municipalities into high costs. It destroys the land we need to grow food. It destroys the woodlands and the wetlands that wild creatures need and that we need to absorb the rain when it falls and hold it for when it's dry. It is creating the worst congestion in North America. We already have the longest commutes, longer than New York City, longer than Los Angeles, and the increasing sprawl is going to drive that congestion even worse over the next decade or two at the rate we're currently going. So we can already see the consequences of the land use planning decisions that have been made over the last several decades in Ontario, and we, in the face of every bit of available evidence, we are now actively doing the wrong things.
And why do you think that is? I'm going to ask you that question from your perspective. Why have we made this right-hand turn to ignore what's right in front of us? I mean, everyone's got kids or family that are going to live into the future. Can they not see what some of us already see?
Well, I've never been able to answer why questions because they're not susceptible of real evidence. But I will say that it's not just our children. People like you and I may very well still be alive for the next 20 years. And I've just looked at the new report that was released last month on Canada's top climate change risks by the expert panel on climate change risk and adaptation, and this is just looking at the next 20 years. And they've pointed out that based on the available evidence that we have, Canada's already got an 85% roughly chance of very serious public infrastructure damage with big consequences just in the next 20 years, and climate change is just accelerating. Mm-hmm. So it's not just our kids. We can't all count on dying on time.
So let's turn to what you're doing these days, Diane. You're going around the province and making presentations. You've issued a few reports. You're available for media interviews such as this. What are you doing?
Well, I'm still doing most of the things I was doing as commissioner, just with no staff and no money. Almost every week I've been in a different city doing my climate talks. Last week I filmed a series of short 10-minute segments that teachers can use to teach climate science and policy in high schools, because we know that the curriculum materials available to teachers are pretty poor. I'm working on some really interesting thought pieces for some influential organizations. And I am working with Erwin Ellman, the fired children's advocate, to see if we can help support a youth climate action summit in the fall.
Okay, that sounds good. We'll keep us informed about that. In your presentation, you talk about mitigation, adaptation, you talk about energy conservation, air pollution and health, all things that we know about. You also spend a portion of time on what we can do personally. Obviously, if our government's not standing up for us, then we've got to do something on a personal level. So walk us through a little bit of what you recommend people do. Let's give us some hope.
Right. Well, the only recipe for hope that I know is to start by looking the facts in the face, even though they're pretty grim, but then looking at each other and finding something concrete to do together. The three things that everyone can do at every level, individuals, families, communities, organizations. Number one, to reduce your own footprint. I'll come back to that in a second. Reduce the amount of climate pollution that you personally create. Number two is to get ready for the wilder, wilder, wackier weather that's coming. And number three, and the most important, is to speak up and demand collective action. Collective problems like climate crisis require collective solutions, and that's what government was invented for. And governments don't act unless the public loudly demands it. So those are the three most important things. Reduce your own footprint, get ready for what's coming in, speak up and demand climate action. In terms of if people want to know how to reduce their own footprint, so the very last thing I put out was a fact sheet on the individual carbon footprints of Ontarians. And the average Ontarian produces half of their climate pollution in just four things. Driving, and we drive on average the most inefficient vehicles in the entire world. We produce more climate pollution per kilometer than anybody else in the world. Number two is home heating. We have very leaky homes that where you're wasting a high percentage of the money that you spend to heat your home because a lot of the heat leaks out. Flying, which does cause enormous harm, and eating meat. So for most Ontarians, for the average Ontarian, those are the four big sources of their pollution, and therefore that's the place to start. It also helps to just not buy and throw away so much stuff. But generally speaking, if you want big impacts, you have to look at your own big part of your biggest footprint.
And you mentioned, the home heating systems, making your home a bit more efficient. What can government do to help with that?
Oh, government can do a tremendous amount. And again, for those interested, my last energy report, which was in March of 2019, you can recognize that cover because I've got a picture of some houses with a nice green scarf around them. Chapter 3 is all about home energy conservation. And government can help, first of all, with information. That's the point of a home energy audit before purchase, is so people actually know what the energy conservation is, the energy consumption of the house that they're about to purchase, because that's the time that people are most likely to do some renovations. And while you're renovating is the cheapest, most effective time to also improve the energy efficiency of a home. Governments have a big role to play, of course, in building standards, construction standards, in training the construction industry so that they have the knowledge and the capacity to do the work and to do it well. And there's also some real challenges in terms of unlocking financing. So, for example, many people live in rental housing, and in rental housing there tends to be a split incentive where the landlord is the one who could make changes to the building, but the tenant pays the energy bills. So the landlord doesn't have an incentive to reduce the energy consumption in the building. So there's a few examples like that where public policy is actually needed to make it easier. Even for people who own their own homes, quite often they find a difficulty in figuring out how to finance the improvements, because what energy efficiency improvements generally do is they require upfront money in order to reduce energy costs over time. And many times there's a fairly rapid payback, but even so, people may not have the cash on hand. And so programs that make it easier to access that the capital cost certainly would help. And for example, there's a property assessed clean energy type of program, sometimes called PACE, which allows loans basically for energy efficiency to be secured with the property taxes, and that allows the cost of the money to be much lower. So there are many things the governments can do to make it easier. One of the good examples we can look at is Sweden. Sweden is just as cold as Canada, and they've been able to reduce the fossil fuels that they use for building heating by more than 85% in not much more than a generation. We haven't done much.
Mm-hmm.
Ontario, we tore up our carbon price with no evidence to support that decision.
Mm-hmm.
Just before the Nobel Prize for Economics was awarded to William Nordhaus for proving that the carbon price is the cheapest, most effective way of moving us towards a low-carbon economy. So the economists know it's what we have to do. There's lots of reasons why we need a carbon price. The current federal carbon price is too low, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
And when you go around the province and you talk to people, what is the reaction? Are you feeling a bit empowered or a bit discouraged? What are you hearing and seeing out there?
Well, I hear some of each. Many people didn't realize how dire the situation is. They still think, oh, there's lots of time, somebody will invent something. You know, it's not really urgent. And I think that after people listen to me, they know that that's not true. On the other hand, I've had lots of people tell me that they do find it really helpful to know what are the key things to do, to know what are the key things to do to reduce their own footprint, and to know that there are public policy steps that really make a difference. And Ontario was doing quite well. We had a lot to be proud of until a year ago. So that's encouraging in a way, because it does show you that public policy can work. And also it's good for people to hear that lots of other people care about the issue. People often feel isolated, that they're the only ones who are worried about it, no one else is doing anything. And in fact, lots and lots of people are really worried about it, but feel helpless. And many are doing something and don't talk about it. So getting more and more visible about the work we are doing, the progress we are making, the wins we get from it, that people find that encouraging. So you look at things like the Grand River Hospital, how much money they've saved by becoming more energy efficient, the Elliott Lake General Hospital, which is now able to put $300,000 a year back into patient care because they got cap-and-trade money and made their building more efficient, the first all-electric gold mine in the world, which is built in Ontario because we had cap-and-trade. There's a lot of good examples around Ontario of how climate action makes other things better. And that gives people some hope.
Great. Very encouraging words. Thank you very much, Diane. I've been speaking with Diane Sachs, president of Sachs Facts. You can find out more by going to her website, Sachs Facts, SAXEFACTS.com. And is there any other way that they can connect with you or find out more?
Well, they can follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter. My Twitter handle is EnviroLaw1. And thank you very much for the opportunity, and congratulations on the growing popularity of your show.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. Email us at earthmatters@newsandcomment.com. News and comment.com.